More breaking news tonight. Palestinians from the Gaza pulling off a stunning and surprising attack on Israel. Hundreds and hundreds of people have been killed.
Hamas militants fired thousands of rockets and invaded several Israeli towns.
Yeah, they've also taken civilians and soldiers hostage while Israel is launching a devastating counterattack at this point. The battles on Israeli soil, though, are the first in a decade. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that we are at war and we will win it.
That was the headline on October 7th, 2023. That's what many Americans woke up to on that day. This amazing attack, this extraordinary, violent, bloody attack by Palestinians. They broke through their fences on numerous places. They fired rockets. They had some of these drone kind of vehicles where they could literally fly into some of the areas. You may recall some of the terrifying images of Palestinian gunmen driving through parts of Israel with machine guns, shooting at cars. Of course, that horrible situation at the concert that happened that day. For most Americans, history began on October 7th, 2023. All of those things they saw, to the majority of Americans, that came out of nowhere. It was like a strike out of the blue. It was a terrorist on par with 9/11 that came in our country that had no valid reason. It was completely unjustified. And everyone was behind the vast, vast majority of not just the United States, but of most of the world. Yeah, those some of those. Thanks for putting that up there, Gary. Those are the images that everyone was greeted with. And of course, when you see all of these, and especially some of those like that one, I'm glad you put that one up, Gary. Thanks for that. Those were some of the ones that would terrify anyone, because you can imagine just your own peaceful street. All of a sudden, there's just gangs of armed men roving down through there and shooting up the neighborhoods, civilian houses, etc. That shocked the nation of Israel. It shocked Americans. And there was absolute, especially among the Biden administration, unequivocal and reflexive, massive support for the Israeli side. And I mean everything you can imagine: diplomatic support, moral support, and certainly military support all across the realm there. Now, that's what most Americans were greeted to, and that's what most people thought. That's the day that history started. But if you pay any attention at all to what has happened, and if you are willing to pay attention more, that you'll see that this did not come out of the blue. And let me just categorically say at the very beginning, there is no justification for terror strikes. No matter what happened before 10/7, it does not justify the slaughter of hundreds of innocent Israeli civilians. Under no question it does. Under any telling of anything, Israel was fully within its rights to respond to that terrorist attack and to hold those accountable or hold those responsible accountable, period. United Nations Security Council resolutions, international law, and just common sense. But, and this is where we get to the big, big, big problem here. How you do it makes every reason in the world. That makes everything to do with what happens next, how you respond. Because if you respond incorrectly, you can not only undo all the injustice that was done to you, but then you know, you can turn yourself from the victim, which they in some sense were on 10/7, into the perpetrator, which is what has happened. And everything that has happened since that time, always in the claim that it was in justification for the atrocity that was done to Israel on that day, has been so grotesquely out of all proportion to what happened that you can't rationally hold that as the standard for why we're doing what we're doing. Even though on this day, you're going to see specials all over the internet. You're going to see specials all over, especially the major media. They're going to recount everything that happened on 10/7/2023, and you won't see much of what you're going to see here. But if you really want to understand how this war started, what preceded this, and then especially on where we can go now, because as we speak, there are peace negotiations going on in Egypt right now. I believe Witkoff and Jared Kushner either are there or are on their way. They're going to continue to participate there. Israeli negotiators are there. Hamas negotiators are there. Qatar, I think, also has some presence. Obviously, Egypt does. They're trying to find some way to bring this war to a merciful end. We'll talk later on about the how that's going to work. We're actually going to have joining us here in a little bit, Matthew Ho, former State Department official, former combat veteran, and somebody who has really paid a lot of attention to this issue from the beginning, long before 10/7. He's actually been to Palestine before, some of the Palestinian areas. We'll bring him on to talk about where this is going to go next. But so that you understand how the current situation factors into what has happened before, I'm gonna go back and tell you, give you some of the reasons why the Palestinians were so upset and angry and why there was such an explosion on 10/7. And this also underscores something we talk about a lot on this channel. There are consequences to actions, even if you don't want them to be. Now, you can blame, and I do, Palestinians and Hamas for what happened to the atrocity on October 7th, 2023. But I can also say that you cannot absolve the Israeli side or the American side in some respects to building up the pressure that resulted in that explosion. They also have culpability, because you cannot take certain actions, especially over decades, and then just wish away the consequences. If you press human beings in certain ways, especially for so much time, it is inevitable that you're going to get a response, whether you like it or not. Take the morality out of it. If you do certain things, it is likely that you're going to get certain outcomes. And if you don't want those outcomes, then you have to have different actions in the current time, whichever time, whenever that is. Israel didn't. And let me show you how. So let's go back, we'll start off in 1946, really, because in the aftermath of World War II, of course, the horrible Holocaust that was suffered by the Jewish nation and the people of Judaism all throughout Europe to the hands of the Nazis, of course, the Holocaust and everything that happened there, many people are not aware today. But even in the aftermath, after the victory of World War II, and when all the revelation of all these concentration camps was made known, the ones that were liberated by the Soviets, the ones that were liberated by the Western Allies, and all the horrors that came back to the TV screens of Americans, we recognize that. And so people opened their arms when welcomed the refugees and the survivors of all that stuff in. That's not actually how it happened. Because there was many reasons why they left the rest of Europe. It wasn't just the Nazis. There was a lot of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic views throughout Europe. And there was not a lot of people that actually wanted, not a lot of countries, even after the war, even on the Western side, that wanted to have Jews in their country, so they were not held warmly. That includes the United States. And not a lot of people are aware, but there were many boats filled with Jewish refugees fleeing the violence that were turned around at American ports. There was a lot of anti-Semitic views in the United States back then. I mean, strong ones. Just imagine today a boatload of refugees coming from war-torn Europe who had suffered the Holocaust at the hands of the Nazis. And instead of welcoming them on our shore, we turned the boat around and send them elsewhere. So there was a lot of moving. The British had been, I think, somewhere around since 1920 or so, in the aftermath of World War I, they had actually started helping what's called this Zionist movement, where there would be Jews that would move back to their homeland. And that happened relatively peaceful. There was a lot of coexistence between the Jews and the Muslims and the Arabs, et cetera, in that whole area before that time. There was problems and some challenges, but they were relatively minor. And for the most part, those groups got along together well. But in the aftermath of World War II, when nobody else wanted the Jews, but the Jews didn't want to stay in Europe anymore, they had to have some place to go. And so they said, how about our ancestral homeland, the historic Israel, you know, the Israel of the Old Testament, of the Bible, et cetera, the Torah. So they said, let's just go and back together there. And so they started doing that. And then this is not going to be a detailed history. There's plenty of things you can find online. But for the purposes here, the bottom line is that through many Western governments, most notably the United States, we supported the formation of a Jewish state on top of the Palestinians. Now, understand that for centuries, way back, there's Arabs and Palestinians who had lived in the land. I think part of the complaint is that there was not a Palestine per se, but these people had been living on this land for literally centuries. And they were there at the time. So for there to be the formation of a Jewish state, you have to expel the people who were living there. And that's what happened. Now, in Israel terms, in most of the Western views, you're going to hear that as the 1948 War of Independence. Not many people talk about who was that war against and what were the causes of that, because like in our own case, when we hear War of Independence in our revolutionary period, it was because we put off the shackles of Great Britain and all the things that they were doing to us, et cetera, and we wanted to live in freedom, et cetera. But in this particular case, the people of Palestine didn't do anything to the Jews at all. They just wanted to live there. And so to force them out, there was a military conquest where people were forcibly expelled from their territory and just shoved out of the area that Israel was going to capture. And so they resisted for a while, but they didn't have an army. The Palestinian side didn't. So there was this big slaughter. It's called the Nakba in the Palestinian viewpoint. And a lot of these things here, just a real quick here, it says during the 1948 war, more than 750,000 Palestinian Arabs fled or were violently expelled from their homes by Zionist militias. The legacy of the Nakba, which translates into disaster or catastrophe, lay bare the violence of the ongoing Palestinian plight. So that's the short answer there, that the Nakba or the Palestinian or the Israeli War of Independence, however you, depending on which side you come down on, the bottom line is 750,000 Palestinian peoples were forced out of their territorial lands, ejected from their homes, or slaughtered in large number. There was just thousands upon thousands of people killed in the process of creating this state. Now then, from 1948 until 1967, most of the Palestinians were fled out into areas that were controlled at the time by Egypt, in what we now consider southern Israel or the Gaza Strip area, and then on into the Sinai and some other areas there. So there was a lot of the Palestinians had been forced out of their land, and then they had resettled in there because that's all they were given to. Well, in 1967, Israel went to war against Egypt. And again, I'm not going to get into all the details, but the bottom line is the Israeli side perceived that the Egyptian side, which had a lot of issues with the Israeli government, that they thought that the Egyptian side was preparing for war against them. So they had a preemptive war where Israel struck, and then they won this pretty much a lightning war, and it turned into the 1967 war, and Israel won it. And I think it was called the Six-Day War in that case. And what happened then was the areas that had been where the Palestinians 20 years earlier had been driven into, now all of a sudden those are occupied. Now then the Israeli military, not the Egyptian government, is in control of those areas. So it becomes an occupation. So they've been pushed out once. Now then they've been pushed in for 20 years into this one area. Now all of a sudden it's an area that's occupied. And so they continue to lose rights and they continue to lose freedoms. And they're continued to be oppressed by the Israeli government. So that builds up for another 20 years. And then we get into 1987, and they call that the first intifada or uprising by the Palestinian people. And a lot of it started with rock throwing. Gary, if you can put that graphic up there from the 1970s. This is the first intifada. Tensions built up for those years until an accident, which included an Israeli truck killing four Palestinian laborers. And on the 9th of December, 1987, the first intifada began. The Palestinians began to use Molotov cocktails against the Israeli defense forces. In return, the IDF began to use live ammunition against the protesters, which as a consequence caused the Palestinians to become even more violent and disruptive. Due to their superiority in every context, the IDF decided to enact a form of collective punishment onto the Palestinians, including the demolition of houses. But the long-term consequences were an enraged Palestinian population less likely to compromise on peace arrangements. So understand that, again, you had the Israeli Defense Forces army and to go in against the Palestinian civilians. They had no army. They had no military. They had no anything at all. And so they just resorted to Molotov cocktails and throwing rocks, et cetera. And then they started getting more violent. And then there were assassinations. There were bombings. There were basically insurgency type activities going on. So now then that's the first intifada. So that settles down. And finally, we had this opportunity to bring peace again. And then the United States gets involved this time. And then in 1993, 6 years later, President Clinton brings the Israeli prime minister and the leader of the Palestinians, Yasser Arafat, to the White House to have a signing ceremony for the Oslo Accords, which included in part this.
Now the efforts of all who have labored before us bring us to this moment, a moment when we dare to pledge what for so long seemed difficult even to imagine, that the security of the Israeli people will be reconciled with the hopes of the Palestinian people, and there will be more security and more hope for all. Today, the leadership of Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization will sign a declaration of principles on interim Palestinian self-government. It charts a course toward reconciliation between two peoples who have both known the bitterness of exile. Now both pledge to put old sorrows and antagonisms behind them and to work for a shared future shaped by the values of the Torah, the Quran, and the Bible.
So just imagine back then, if the President of the United States had been willing to use the full authority and coercive pressure in a positive direction for the United States, that vision could possibly have come to a vision. But just imagine, you've heard me many, many times say from the beginning of this 10-7 here, the 2023 until today, that until you have a situation to where you have the potential for a peace and a future hope for both the Israelis and the Palestinians, you will have peace for neither. And this was on graphic display in 1993. President Clinton said it correctly at that time. You have to have hopes for the Palestinians and hopes for a peace for all. And at that time, he said, you know, they volunteered or vowed rather to bring in and make it happen. Now, obviously, it didn't happen, and unfortunately. And so with all of that hope, the dashed hopes caused even more despondency among the Palestinians because for various reasons, and each side kept blaming the other, the Oslo Accords really came to nothing. And so then about 7 years later, then we have another intifada. Now the second intifada. Gary, if you can bring it out. The second intifada here. Within a few years, however, it became apparent that Israel had no intention of relinquishing control of the territories it had occupied since 67. By the end of the 1990s, the number of Israeli settlers to the West Bank had more than doubled to more than 205,000. By the way, right now it's closer to 750,000. It shows you that it never stopped. By the late 1990s, public confidence in the ability of the Palestinian Authority to promote the national interest had waned, and Palestinians noted with dismay the unmistakable signs of authoritarianism and corruption. Some groups, led by Hamas, had never accepted the premise of the interim period of autonomy, intended it was supposed to have lasted for 5 years. The lack of progress and even regression in negotiations seemed to support their misgivings. Those are two important things. So you see that there is really blame to go around on both sides. Number one, the Israelis did not relinquish the areas they were supposed to. They continued to send settlers into areas where they were not authorized to have it, especially in the West Bank area, but also in the Gaza at this particular time here. But then on the Palestinian side, they begin to work against their own interest. We got to be honest here, folks. The Palestinians are victims in many respects, but it's some of the wounds are self-inflicted, and this was one of them. And this was going to be an enduring issue here, which, by the way, Netanyahu would later on exploit to his advantage, in that the Palestinian Authority was riven with all kinds of corruption and people who were on the take, et cetera, who were out for themselves, and they were looking out for their own enrichment, not for that of the people. And the people recognized it. And in fact, that was part of what led to the rise. And I think it was 2005, the elections that brought Hamas into power in 2005. But they were born basically in this period of time here. So that lasted until about 2006. And they finally kind of got it back into at least a stable situation. Now then, that lasted another number of years. And I want to now look to, you see that it was like 20 years from the Nakba to the first intifada, and then about 20 years after that before we got to the second intifada. And now then, not quite 20 years, but now that we get into the to the 2000 period, and then from 2006 to 2023, we again went on kind of a slow burn and a slow boil. And then that started reaching a product. And in fact, it was Foreign Affairs in January of 2023 wrote this article here saying, are we on the verge of a third intifada? And now remember, February 2023, no political process holds promises for the Palestinian independence, and ordinary Palestinians are growing frustrated with their established groups and leaders that reject the violence. So again, you see this playing out because the things that they've been promised are not being delivered by Israel, and their own leaders they view as being corrupt and unable to bring anything. So their frustrations are growing because there is no path to peace and a hope for a future. Then you see that in yet another foreboding development in December 2022, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, there's his name again, had been coming up since the late 90s, created a new government that put settlers, political extremists, and racists in key positions overseeing the West Bank. So now that we're expanding from Gaza to problems with the Palestinians in the West Bank, all this leads to a despairing, inescapable conclusion. The odds of a third intifada are higher than they have been in years. So this tells you that 7 months before 10/7, it was recognized that the pressures were building up inside of Gaza. It continued, and all the Palestinian areas, including the West Bank, the pressures were building up. Well, that came to an even bigger head during the summer of 2023. You've heard me mention this before. Now we have some details here. Gary, if you can put that other one up, thank you. More than 200 Palestinians and nearly 30 Israelis had been killed in the year heading into the summer. I believe it was August when this one here was written. And you see that more than 200 Palestinians and 30 Israelis have been killed, a level of violence surpassing last year's entire death toll and the highest number of fatalities since 2005, which was basically the end of the second intifada. For Winsland, UN Special Coordinator in the Middle East process told the UN Security Council on Monday that escalating violence is being fueled by a growing despair about the future among the Palestinians and a lack of progress towards achieving an independent state, things that have been promised for many times. You may also recall that in 2013, President Obama went to Israel and gave this huge speech that was attended by thousands upon thousands of Israeli people, and he celebrated the possibility of a Palestinian state and said, this is for your interest. This is what you should do, and the Palestinians agreed with it. Many Israelis agreed with it. Benjamin Netanyahu didn't, but many of the people did. And there was hope that the president who campaigned on hope, change and hope, brought with that to Israel. And so many people wanted it that time. But you see that 10 years later, it had amounted to nothing. And again, hopes that were dashed, which turns into a growing frustration, both with their own leadership and with the actions of the Israelis. And then now I want to show you one last thing here. This is two weeks before the explosion on 10/7. There's a couple of Palestinians that were interviewed here. You're going to be careful. I have to read the language at the bottom. I'll give you a sense at the bottom, but this is where they were feeling right before this happened.
دخول يومين وإغلاق معبر بيت حنون أمام هؤلاء العمال اللي هم أصلاً بيعانوا من حصار حوالي 17 عام على قطاع غزة. خسائر العمال تتجاوز يومياً 5 مليون شيكل، بمعنى حوالي مليون ونص دولار خسائر عمال يومياً. العمال بيعانوا أصلاً من أوضاع صعبة داخل قطاع غزة.
استمرار إغلاق المعابر على قطاع غزة وخاصة معبر بيت حنون بالتأكيد سيزيد من حالة الضغط على الواقع الإنساني الضعيف أصلاً بفعل الحصار الإسرائيلي، وهذا يعني زيادة في حجم التوترات والغضب الفلسطيني والاحتياج يتحمل المسؤولية الكاملة عن تداعيات هذه الإجراءات التي تهدف إلى العقاب الجميع لشعبنا الفلسطيني وتشديد الحصار على أهلنا.
So I apologize for the small text there, but the first guy was especially complaining about that they were being hemmed in on all sides. There, certain parts of the Gaza Strip were cut off. Some of the possibilities for the conduits were shut down, and sometimes they were open, sometimes they were shut down. There were not jobs to go around. There was quality of life was low. There was no path to anything. The second guy was especially talking about again the increasing frustrations, the lack of jobs, and the fact that their own leadership was again viewed as being incapable and that they were corrupt and they weren't getting things done. So they were frustrated, primarily with the Palestinian Authority. As I mentioned a minute ago, that's something that Benjamin Netanyahu had intentionally done because he had sought to pit Hamas, which, by the way, despite what he claims, and this is all over Western media now, you can find it. It's very easy. New York Times has talked about this. The Washington Post, Benjamin Netanyahu, despite his claims to the contrary, funded Hamas through Qatar. So it wasn't Qatar was funding terrorist groups. No, it was Benjamin Netanyahu that was funneling money intentionally through Qatar into Hamas because he wanted to keep them as a counterweight to the Palestinian Authority. If he can keep the Palestinians politically divided and antagonistic against each other, then there would be no pressure on him from outside to actually have a two-state solution, which had been American policy all the way through, even into the Biden administration. Before all of this exploded, and Biden continued to say all the way through with no power and with no legitimacy, oh yeah, we're looking for a two-state solution, even though we did nothing to bring it to about. So all of that, all of those pressures, both internal and external, in this area, in this sense of despair, the lack of hope, and being pushed upon by the Israeli government and these policies that prohibited them from even having any kind of a life, all exploded on 10/7. So it bears repeating, I'm not justifying what they did on 10/7 at all, but I'm telling you, and you have to listen, if you care about Israel, if you care about peace in the Middle East, you have to recognize rationally and logically that if you keep having these kinds of policies, no human group on the planet is going to simply coerce or just melt away. This is a predictable consequence of it. And so now here we are on 10/7/2025. And the question is, where are we going to go next? And for that, we're going to bring in Matthew Ho, a friend of the show here, a guy who spent some time in the Middle East and has really studied this issue a lot. First of all, Matt, welcome to the show. A bit of a somber day, but really glad to have you here.
Okay. Thank you, Danny. Yeah. There's always, you know, with the dogs, you're always concerned that something is, yeah.
But, I do.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We've had that happen, you and I.
Well, listen, let me just, first of all, just kind of get your thoughts on this now 2-year anniversary since the terrorist attack here and, you know, all the history that led up to this. You know, kind of how do you view this this situation, Danny? How are you feeling about it?
Well, I appreciate what you're doing here, Danny, making clear that this is a chapter, right? This is a phase or an episode or whatever you want to describe it as, that history did not start on October 7th. And that is unfortunately the way that many still view it. Certainly, if you read an American media report or watch an American media story, the implication is that things were going well, that there was peace, that there was no occupation, that there was no apartheid, that, as you noted in your report there, that hundreds of Palestinians hadn't been killed in Gaza and the West Bank in the months in 2023 prior to October 7th. You know, 2023 was the most violent year for the Palestinians prior to October 7th. In decades since the second intifada. You know, I was able to go to Palestine last year, visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and this is November of 2024. If people recall, in the spring of 2023, leading up to October 7th, you had violent mob attacks by Israelis on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they heavily damaged the mosque. And when I was there 18 months later, the windows, the doors, were still broken. The walls were still damaged. The Israelis refused to allow the Palestinians to repair the mosque. But can you imagine that type of affront, that type of insult, that type of attack on a people, such as what the Israelis had done in 2023, whether it was just the violence of the Israeli army and the settlers, whether it was things like the mob attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, whether it was the pogroms that were occurring throughout the West Bank as settlers backed by the Israeli military burned Palestinian villages. So to your point exactly, what did people expect the Palestinians to do? And under international law, and I would add also as well, natural law, a people have a right to resist. And so while I agree with you about the attacks on October 7th that killed hundreds of civilians being war crimes and reprehensible, as well as strategically counterproductive, the attacks by the Palestinians on the Israeli military and security forces, the people that were keeping them in what was effectively a concentration camp, were justified. You know, I mean, if you're occupying power, you have to assume the risk of an attack by those you're occupying. And that's what happened on October 7th. But now here we are 2 years later, and I'm sure we could go back and look at what you and I said about this 2 years ago. I'm sure we talked about this, right? The idea, though, that we would have seen what we saw, I think most were in agreement that the Israelis were going to take October 7th for what they could use it for, that October 7th was giving them the opportunity to carry out and fulfill what was started in 1948 and what was continued in 1967, the Nakba and the Naksa, which you covered there, those ethnic cleansing campaigns, and that now was a chance.
And then, Matt, if you could, because I actually I was short on time and actually didn't have the Naksa. Some people don't even know there's a difference between this. What was the Naksa, if you could?
Sure. The Naksa is the Palestinian term for the 1967 war, the campaign launched by the Israelis. Israelis fully admit the only people that seem to think that somehow the Israelis were launching a preemptive war are those who have such a superficial knowledge of this. It's embarrassing, which means most of the American media and most of the American politicians. But, in 1967, Israel launched the 1967 war, and they took large parts of the West Bank. They took Jerusalem and they took Gaza. And during that campaign, hundreds of thousands of people were expelled from their homes. Many were forced to go into exile in throughout the region, whether it be Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, into other parts of the West Bank or into Gaza. And it was a campaign that was premeditated, it was planned, and it reflected the desire of the Israelis to continue what was started in 1948 with the Nakba. And Naksa simply means, whereas Nakba means catastrophe, Naksa means roughly little catastrophe or continuing catastrophe.
Let me kind of put this in context here. I want to put up a map here that shows what the region looked like in 1946 all the way through to 1999. And it's not a whole lot different from that lesson. But you see there the dark areas were where the Palestinians lived. The land that they had in the white areas where the Jews were. So as I mentioned, the Jews have been there since at least 1920, maybe a little bit before that. But at least from what I've read, relatively copacetic in how they lived together until things started changing in 1947. And then you see and then after the 1967, which you just mentioned, you see yet more white, yet less of the area that where the Palestinians lived. And then by 1999 today, it's just almost dots in what's known as the West Bank. And then that strip there in Gaza. So you can see that the people were progressively ripped off their lands. And you just got to understand how any people would feel if that's what they'd been done over all those decades.
Right. And demographically, you saw such a major change in Palestine during people's lifetimes. So starting in 1900, the Jewish population was roughly about 2% of Palestine. And about 40% of those Jews were immigrants. So you go back into the 19th century and you're looking at a Jewish population of roughly 1% or so. And then the 1920s, you're at 7 or 8% Jewish population. In the 1930s, it passes 20%. And then you get to 1947, where the population, the Jewish population is about 500,000 and roughly one third approaching 40%. Of the population there. So you see this massive demographic swing in Palestine as a result, for no other reason than the immigration that came from Europe. And as you said, certainly I think anyone who's reasonable can understand the need for Jews in Europe to have fled, to have wanted to have a place of their own. Following World War II, of course, that migration greatly increases. You go from, again, about 500,000 Jews in Palestine in 1947 to well over 1 million by the early 50s. And now, of course, there's about 7.5 million, 8 million Jews in Israel and as well as in Palestine as well. But that demographic shift, anyone can imagine what type of pressures that put on. So as immigrants from as Jewish immigrants from Europe arrived daily, weekly, monthly. They did purchase land, but also too, as they grew in power and size, they began to seize land. And so in the it starts really in the 19th century, but by the 1920s, you're seeing real violence occurring between the Jews and the Palestinians. And when I say Palestinians, I mean both the majority Muslims and the minority Christians. What happens, of course, after 1948 is that most of the Christians leave. Most of the Christians flee. Flee the country in a way and go to other countries, as opposed to the Palestinian Muslims, who either were forcibly relocated within historic Palestine, or, as I said before, went to places like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, etc. But I mean, so when you go back to if Gary could put that map back up again, if you go back to the partition plan in 1948, you know, and you understand that in 46, that's what it looks like. And Jews are about a third of the population. And then you see what the plan is. And what you see in 47 is essentially the United Nations plan. And you're saying, wait, hang on a second. A third of the population is going to get about 60% of the land, including some of the most arable or usable, certainly along the coast, those types of things. You say, this makes no sense. That's not fair. Who would ever accept that deal? And that's essentially what happens. And people who are interested in this, read about what occurs in the newborn United Nations, the bullying, the hostility, the force used by particularly the United States to push through Israeli statehood over the objections of many countries. You have to remember the United Nations at that time was much smaller. The countries that were to gain independence from things like the British Empire had not been seated in the United Nations left yet. So when people talk about 1948, the United Nations did this and that, you have to put it in the context of how bad a deal it was, how crooked the actual procedure was in the United Nations to get that deal through, who actually was present in the United Nations at that time, you know, and that, you know, right. And when you understand that, you begin to understand, I think, the larger context or background of what has been occurring and how these are grievances held by the Palestinians that are real. I mean, you go back to say, okay, speed up to 1967, the Israelis take large parts of the Palestinian areas, destroy hundreds of villages, expel hundreds of thousands of people. Modern day Gaza, you have roughly three quarters of the population of Gaza, maybe more, are those descendants. The mass majority of the population in Gaza are refugees. And so what you have happening on October 7th then is those towns and villages that were attacked by the Palestinians on that day, many of those who were attacking those villages had parents or grandparents who had originally lived in those villages. So there's a real historic cycle here that goes beyond the academic and the intellectual, but the personal. You can imagine that as they assigned who was going to attack who, the Palestinian men who carried out these attacks, if they could, would have wanted to attack and go into the villages and towns, again, where their parents and their grandparents had been forcibly expelled from, right? So there's a personal aspect of this for the Palestinians that can't be ignored. A symbol you see in Palestine constantly of this, you know, of this issue about the right of return, the right of the Palestinians to go back to their home, is the key. And you see the key constantly because Palestinians actually still have the keys to the homes that they were kicked out of in the 40s, that they were kicked out of in the 60s, right? That they're being kicked out of now in the West Bank. This is an issue where the history is tied so closely with the personal lives, with the familial lives of the Palestinians that, you know, it's something that doesn't get enough attention or discussion of in the West. And I think it's the type of thing where, of course, you know, it's that issue of put yourself in their shoes. What would you do?
Yeah, and that's what too few people do. They don't even know what shoes to get into. In the amount of time we have left here, I want to real quick run to where all this is at now. And one of the maps that was posted actually by President Trump on Truth Social a couple of days ago, he said this is the first objective. Gary, if you could put the yellow line map up there. He said this is where the Israelis might withdraw to. So we saw on the bigger maps there this tiny little strip, what is the Gaza Strip in comparison with the whole of Israel. Now you see what they're even talking about right now is to shrink it down even further to just what's in that enclave surrounded by that yellow line. And maybe Israel agrees to it, maybe they don't. But I wonder if you can kind of give us a sense of what you think the Palestinian people will think about this deal.
Oh, we know. I mean, there's been public opinion polls that show, you know, late last week, only 8% of the Palestinians in Gaza supported it. You know, of course, they have no reason to trust the Israelis or the Americans. And why should they? I mean, as soon as Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu announced this deal, Benjamin Netanyahu speaks in Hebrew to his fellow Israelis and say, our troops aren't leaving Gaza and there'll never be a Palestinian state. I mean, right away, not even like a decent interval of a day or two. I mean, immediately. I mean, and let alone the history, things we've discussed, you know, many times before. Why should the Palestinians trust this?
Well, you know, he had pounded on the lectern on his speech at the UN General Assembly and unequivocally said there will be no Palestinian state. That would be the ultimate reward for 10-7, et cetera. And yet in that 20-point peace plan, allegedly crafted by Witkoff and the Trump administration, it says that there has to be a possibility for a Palestinian state. And then you're saying that coming out of that, in English, he didn't actually address that part. He addressed other things which were negative. But then you're saying in Hebrew, right after that, he reiterated what he said at the UNGA.
Exactly. As well as the fact that Israeli troops are not leaving Gaza. And, you know, I mean, and that's not just Netanyahu. That, you know, his perspective, his views, that is the perspective and views and desires of the Israeli body politic and the vast majority of Israeli civilians. There is no one of any political significance in Israel, Israeli Jewish political significance, who is calling for the removal of the troops or the establishment of a Palestinian state. I mean, there are some, but they're not. They have, again, no political significance. And you've seen the way the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, has spoken on this issue. They have been firm. All the Israeli Jewish Knesset members have been clear, no statehood, and the vast majority of them want to see the genocide, the ethnic cleansing carried out to the end. I believe whether or not the deal holds, it results in the same for the Palestinians as we've been seeing. I mean, I think you see essentially if the deal doesn't hold, the Israelis continue with their ethnic cleansing campaign. They are essentially where they were about a year ago before they stopped what was called the General's Plan to cleanse the North, before they were stopped in their efforts at that by the January 2025 ceasefire, which was coincided with Donald Trump's inauguration. Many people believe that that was the purpose in it, was Trump was trying to put his fingerprints on it for his own ego purposes, because once the Israelis violated and ended that ceasefire in March 2025, Trump, of course, was happy about it, went along with it, did nothing to stop it. I mean, not even close to stopping it, you know, egged it on. And now what we see now, and if people want to doubt me, I'll just say you haven't been paying attention to this man we have as president. You have, of course, at the end of the week, the Nobel Peace Prize is going to be announced. And this seems so fantastic, right, Danny? It seems so farcical. It seems like the most absurd satire that the president of the United States would put the screws, would be hard on Benjamin Netanyahu, right, for a reason that pertains to him getting the Nobel Peace Prize. And so my view is that when a Nobel Peace Prize is awarded at the end of the week and Donald Trump doesn't get it, you'll see either an immediate Israeli resumption of their ethnic cleansing campaign, of the genocide, or they'll provide a decent interval. They'll give it a week or two or 3 weeks, and there'll be some excuse as to start it again, and they'll blame the Palestinians, of course, for, you know, restarting it as they do. You know, if you watch like the American spokespeople, if you watch Tammy Bruce, the spokesperson for the State Department, she will say that Hamas violated the ceasefire and ended the ceasefire, and they're the ones who ended the ceasefire in March, not the Israelis. I mean, just absolutely crazy, upside down, bizarro, you know, non-factual statements. But that's what they'll do. They'll stick to their narrative. But the point being, I feel, is that if the deal fails, back to the ethnic cleansing, back to what they were trying to accomplish last year, push everyone out of the north, push them down into essentially concentration camps in the south, immiserate them, continue to murder them, and hope that eventually some location will be made available for an exodus of the Palestinian people. If the deal holds, it will look less violent. I think there will be less Palestinians killed. It won't be a full-fledged genocide, but it will still be ethnic cleansing. And so you'll still have the IDF carrying out their operations, handing it over to what's called the International Stabilization Force, which is not United Nations Blue Helmets. This International Stabilization Force will be under the command of the American-Israeli Board of Peace that will be chaired by Donald Trump. And the viceroy, the man who will be the colonial administrator of Gaza, will be Tony Blair. And that's who this International Stabilization Force report to. And the idea is to bring in regional troops into Gaza to police and occupy Gaza. And who would those troops be? You know, if it's the Emiratis and the Saudis, we saw what they did in Yemen. I mean, like, so the idea that somehow this is going to be anything other than a proxy force to continue the ethnic cleansing, I just don't understand it. The 20-point peace plan itself is so vague and so generalized that really with the Israelis and the Americans as the determiners in terms of what does it mean for an area to be terror-free? What does it mean for an area to be demilitarized, right? I mean, it's up to them to decide, the Israelis and the Americans, when it is time to stop military operations. And again, it's so vague and general.
Yeah.
They can never stay. They have the absolute right by this peace plan to continue military operations indefinitely. I mean, so
let me ask you, because we're running a little bit low on time here. What are the possibilities here? Like what is, for the Palestinian side, for example, what is the best case that's rationally possible? And what is the worst case that's rationally possible?
Best case is that they're under a foreign subjugation where they have some degree of limited local control. Aid is being administered, as the deal says, by third parties. So not that Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that's running death traps. They are disguised as aid distribution points. They are able to live lives again in these localized communities as the plan goes forward to either bring in Israeli settlers or to build Trump Towers. I think that's the best case, but at least the genocide is finished and the military actions are infrequent or specific or localized. Still happening, okay.
Before you give me the dark side, let me caveat it with something else or a precursor. I personally cannot imagine not just Netanyahu himself, not just Smotrich or Ben-Gvir, but the whole panoply of Israeli political leaders and many people for that matter. I can't imagine them saying, we've had this opportunity for the first time in the beginning to finally have a shot at expelling them. I can't see any way that they'll settle for just, okay, we'll just freeze everything where it's at and kind of get back to where we were right before all this stuff started. It seems to me that they will do something to make sure that doesn't happen, to continue trying the ethnic cleansing. You right. Get the final word.
Right. And then, you know, and I give that what I just described there as the best case. I give that, you know, if I had to bet a dollar, Danny, I'd put a nickel down on that, you know, I mean, so I'm looking at 5 or 10% chance on that. And then the more likely case is when the deal fails and you just resume the ethnic cleansing, whether it's immediately or it's, you know, a decent interval is provided, or the plan goes forward and it's just essentially a different form of subjugation. That it's just a different form of occupation and apartheid. The Palestinians are kept in concentration camps, or the million plus that are on the Almazi neighborhood on the coast there in Rafah. They essentially are living in a ghetto. And between this ghetto and between the concentration camps, there's nothing but desolation. And the apartheid walls and the roads that have been so successful for the Israelis in the West Bank are utilized in Gaza. These areas of these Palestinian areas in Gaza are disconnected from one another. There is no Palestinian governance except for the de facto governance that exists within the camps. I think within the camps, for lack of a better term, I mean, I'm not sure what's to call those, what will be, you'll have control either by the Palestinian resistance or possibly by the Palestinian collaborationist gangs that we've seen Israel backing these last 2 years in Gaza. And then you'll have either IDF or International Stabilization Forces killing as they please. And of course, aid, food, medicine, water being utilized to further the subjugation of the people.
Okay, sorry.
You can go on in this dystopian manner, right. But I think that's where we're headed.
Let me ask one final question, which is, in my view, the only possible thing that could interdict all of those awful things you're talking about, and that is international response. Now, we've had, I think it was 156 countries recognize a Palestinian state here. And I know most of that is just symbolic, but everything's not symbolic. There has been Turkey, for example, they cut off economic aid, Spain cut off military supplies, et cetera. If these things, if this darker version you're talking about starts to manifest, do you see any possibility that the West, like maybe it did with South Africa, not the West, just the rest of the world, not even just the West, might finally start to take some actual concrete actions and try to do something to bring it into this? Do you think there's a possibility of that?
No, I don't believe so.
That's not encouraging.
No, it's not. I don't believe so. I don't think, I think what you'll see is a push by the Americans and the Israelis to paint things as the new normal in Gaza. The information will be tightly controlled, et cetera. The propaganda campaign, as we're seeing here in the U.S. with, say, the purchase of Paramount and TikTok by Larry and David Ellison, you know, the propaganda efforts by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs paying $7,000 to influencers to post on behalf of Israel. Donald Trump's National Security Policy Memorandum number 7, which makes, you know, essentially this conversation, Danny, an act of terrorism, right? I mean, you're going to have those efforts to either buy out or censor voices. And as long as the Americans are backing Israel, then it really doesn't matter. I mean, Israel is a small country. We can continue to support it. Its GDP is, you know, its budget is $60 billion a year. I mean, you can imagine the American Congress providing $10, $20, $30 billion a year in economic assistance, as we did up into the 1970s. We provided a lot of economic assistance to keep Israel afloat and to make sure it would eventually be successful economically. We can do that again. The Israelis understand that. Many Israelis believe in this idea of Fortress Israel, because that's the way that God intended it, that this fits with their cosmic, their biblical, the historical understanding of Israel and the world. Everyone is against us. That's always the way it's been. And some of them embrace this idea. You had Benjamin Netanyahu speaking about a super Sparta. And I think backing all of that as well is this idea that it's only a matter of time till things go back to normal. So if you have the case where, say, the peace plan works, or even a genocide continues, the peace plan fails, the genocide continues, and you get to this position where you have some type of status where the Palestinians are in the camps, they're no longer reducing Gaza the way we've seen it being reduced and destroyed this last 2 years. What's the acceptable number of Palestinians killed every day, every week, every month, so that the Europeans don't get offended? I mean, we've witnessed them kill 20,000 children, murder, the Israelis murder 20,000 children. We've witnessed that for 2 years now. And the actual real actions by the Europeans are insignificant, I mean, you're right. I mean, so I think that's why I say I have extremely little or no hope for this.
Well, we'll have to see where it goes. All we can do is put forth the truth like we're doing here, and to put in stark contrast the feckless and the, in my view, amoral actions of so many Western governments, to include our own in complicity in this genocide. And that's what we can do. We can just go make our voices heard and just pray that at some point God himself intervenes and does something to turn off this insanity. But in any case, I really appreciate you, because you've provided such a depth of knowledge of this that that's just not given on mainstream media anywhere. And if people want the truth, they can keep coming here for it. And we really appreciate your willingness to tell the truth, no matter what it is.
All right. Thanks, Danny. I appreciate what you did here today. Again, making sure people understand that this didn't start on October 7th.
Thank you very much. And we appreciate you guys too. Be sure and join us in about 1 hour, because we're going to stick in the Middle East there. We have Colonel Doug McGregor going to come back and tell us that be careful, because there may be warnings of a new military action against Iran. Some consider that actually inevitable. We'll talk to Doug to find out why people are saying that. Join us today at 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.